Welcome to Blind Line, I'm Jonathan Mosen. This is the original interactive talk show exclusively for the blind and vision impaired across the internet. Nice to have you with us. Well, the program is recorded today. I'm in Auckland, which is New Zealand's largest city, to meet someone who's come all the way from, well, you're based in Virginia, aren't you? Is it, well, you are in Arlington somewhere?
Right, we're in Arlington, yeah. Virginia, yeah. Right across
so the isn't that strange? But we're speaking with Doug Wakefield, and Doug is someone who many people have requested us to interview for good reasons. Doug's currently involved with the Access Board, and we'll get to that shortly, but he also has made a significant contribution in other respects to the assistive technology industry. So it's great to have you here. How are you enjoying New Zealand?
Very nice. I mean, you know, we're having cold, icy weather in February, and the weather down here, 70s, 80s, cool at night. I'll go back maybe in May or June, you know.
Yeah.
Actually, we got to go back in a couple of days, but great place to stay.
So you've swapped the cold, icy weather for some cold, icy beer and a barbecue.
Well, this is true. As I told people, I like to take my vacation in summer. It just happened that summer is somewhere else.
That's right. And you've been around New Zealand's South Island this time because you're a fairly frequent visitor to New Zealand.
Yeah, this is about our... We were down here for the millennium changeover and I was down here in 97, but had never been down to the South Island. So my wife and I and our two local friends, Mary and Clive, that we're staying with, hired a driver and a car, and we've been all over the South Island, from Christchurch to Stewart Island, where we were 2,900 miles from the South Pole.
Good part of the world, and some lovely wine being made down there. I don't know if you're into wine, but it's...
Oh, yes, Chardonnay is very good, Marlborough yep. District, and yeah, we had plenty of wine, good fishing. Judy caught an octopus.
Goodness gracious. Wow. And did you? What did you do with the octopus?
Nobody will touch it. It was very interesting because apparently when they grab you, they don't like to let go. And they have very strong suckers on their legs. Judy touched it and got, not bitten, but it grabbed her, but she got away. But the captain of the boat just knocked it off the hook onto the deck and said, you know, leave it alone. It'll find a hole to get back into the sea. And it just kind of slithered around. And I checked it out with a foot. I had shoes on, of course, because I wanted to see how big it was. It was bigger than I would want to pick up. And it slithered around, found a way under the rail and back into the sea.
How incredible. Wow.
It was fun.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about... let's go back to the beginning. You've been blind all your life, I take it.
Yes.
Yeah. And you're... The first time I heard of you, of course, was through the Newsbits magazine, and the whole world stopped when Newsbits arrived, trying to get the latest technology information. But you've had a background in radio that precedes Newsbits by quite a long way, I understand.
Oh, yeah. Actually, 1970, I started work for New Jersey Public Television doing science writing and producing, and I worked there for 8 years. And then moved to Department of Agriculture and did radio and television for the research arm of agriculture. Oh, until 1985. Plus, I did several NPR documentaries.
NPR is a fascinating animal, isn't it? It relies on a lot of public contributions. And how much taxpayer funding does it get these days?
I have no idea. Absolutely no idea. I know that there was some wisecracks made by one of our former senators, Newt Gingrich, about Big Bird being the ultimate capitalist or something. But, it's always an issue people fight over.
The U.S. is, I think, one of the few... major Western democracies, if not the only one, that doesn't have a fully government-funded public broadcasting system.
Yeah, that's true.
How do you feel about that?
How do I feel about
it?
Well, I think it depends on where you live. Some of our NPR stations, the NPR feed itself is very good. In our area of Washington, D.C., we have a station that doesn't, a public television, public radio station that doesn't take all of the NPR feed. And does an awful lot of straight classical music. And so we don't have a good 24-hour news radio and feature radio that NPR actually is providing, and some cities do have access to it. We just In our area, we don't.
Hmm. And I presume you can get that off the web these days.
You can, but, you know, sometimes it's nice just to have a radio running in the background.
Yeah.
Right now, what we do, for instance, is we have a radio that'll pick up TV channels. And since September 11th, whenever I'm going out of the house, going out to work or something, I always hit the TV channel, bring it up, see if Tom Brokaw's on. If he's not on, it's safe to go.
Right. How's that affected your life and the lives of people that you are close to, that whole experience of September the 11th, being so close to it as you were?
It doesn't go away, because in our area, and I understand on the news that they're beginning to consider dropping it, we're under a 24-hour air cap where we have fighters overhead and AWACS planes 24 hours a day from Washington to New York City. And every once in a while, in the middle of the night, you'll hear these jets coming over very low, and you wonder, what's happened? Do they know something we don't? Probably. And we also, I'm very skittish about riding on our metro, especially where it goes under the river. It's on your mind all the time.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk a little bit about your interest in technology. And can you recall what your first encounter with a computer was?
Yes. It was interesting. I went to I wouldn't say it was a technology show, because there was only one computer. But there was, you know, some other gadgets. Yeah, there was an Opticon there. Probably the Opticon was the very first piece of real technology that I learned to use. And to this day, my wife and I both agree that if you had to give up everything except one piece, what we would keep is the Opticon. It has never been supplanted by any other technology. But then I remember seeing the VersaBrail, the old VersaBrail. The cassette based, and I couldn't get into it. I didn't know what the heck I would do with it. I remember hearing about Raise.dot computing doing a lot with Apples, and even in the early 80s I was thinking, what can you do with a computer? And I really didn't catch on for quite a while. And I went and saw a $25,000, what is it called? ITS, Information Through Speech. This will test the history of those listening as to how far back that goes. Do you remember Information Through Speech, John?
I don't remember that one.
Oh, this is the first Maryland Computer Services, MCS.
Okay,
that they came out with. It was a modified old HP.
Oh, yes.
No hard disk. It just had floppy disks. And that's what actually, though, I finally got bitten, not because of the ITS. My actual getting turned on to computers, I went to a consumer or home computer, whatever you want to call it, show in Washington, and a fellow was showing the 994A TI, Texas Instrument.
Right, yes.
And he had it connected to some telephone service, some internet. It wasn't even called internet then. And he was able to access and have it speak out loud the AP Newswire. And I said, I've got to have that.
Right.
And so that's where I started. I bought a TI 994A at, like, Toys R Us or something. And then I bought a bunch of modules. There was a fellow in Detroit, Michigan, whose name I've totally forgotten now, who was selling specialized stuff to make it talk. And so I think I spent $89 for the computer and about $1,200 for accessories. And the speech was, excuse me, the speech was, it would dump once, there was no review.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, yep. It just, you know, talked. And the speech was absolutely horrible. It came through your TV speaker. But I could actually do email, retrieve email with that thing. and listen to news items. And that's how I got started, because after that I went to CPM, and my first items that I ever sold were Zorbas for a company called Avos, A-V-O-S, in Minneapolis.
So let's go back and talk about the Opticon for a bit, because actually this topic came up. We did a feature just last week on what people thought the state of technology would be in 10 years from now. And we thought we might save this program and play it back in 10 years' time to see how accurate everybody was. But we inevitably got to talking a bit about the past, and the Opticon came up. I made the point during that program that people who use the Opticon really depend on it. They couldn't imagine life without it, and in some cases their livelihoods depend on it. Why is it then, do you think, that there hasn't been the revival of the Opticon that so many people have talked about and never really been able to follow through on?
Well, my opinion is about as worth as, you know, is worth as much as anybody else's, but not worth any more. And I have my thoughts on that. Basically, it took a lot of really intense use to get good at it. You had to really want to. Somehow you have to see the need and enjoy learning. It's very hard to conceptualize or to put into verbalize exactly what it takes to learn the Opticon, because you're starting out at 10 to 20 words a minute at best, and that's pretty slow. Plus, you have to be a pretty good Braille reader. You have to be accustomed to using your tactile sense, and you have to have reasonably decent coordination in terms of moving, you know, the camera and coordinating. Instead of eye-hand, it's hand-hand coordination. And a lot of people, especially older people, and I'm saying older 40s and 50s, really weren't motivated because they'd already established patterns in their own lives of dealing with print and so on. So they didn't have the motivation to learn it. I think the biggest mistake of all with the Opticon was not making a much bigger push to have it taught in first and second grade to blind children. I think that would have made a big difference.
That happened here, you know. I can remember being taught the Opticon as a 9 or 10-year-old.
So you're an Opticon user?
Well, I'm not now. To be honest, I never took to it. I certainly see the value of it, though. I wonder whether the replacement might in the near future be some kind of system where you can put a sheet of paper into a slot, something like a PCMCIA slot, and have the result come up on a refreshable Braille display, the OCR technology built in somewhere.
This concerns me, and this is just my opinion. People, I think, want to change the Opticon too much. The versatility of the Opticon is in the flexibility of what it can read. For example, it's pretty easy. We have a programmable thermostat, and we can read its output with the Opticon when we're resetting it or whatever. We've often had contests at home, not real ones, but, you know, like, what's the hardest thing you ever did? And it's really hard to say. Judy, my wife, climbed into the oven once because she was ordering some new part and they wanted the serial number. And the serial number of the oven was on the back wall in the oven. So she was able to get into the oven and read that.
That is impressive.
Yeah, I've done, when I've set up, say, a MIDI keyboard, I've had to look at the back to read the in and out, you know, which plug. Saves time as opposed to experimenting. And it was a little bit tricky to read that. I mean, there are a lot of things. I've built models by looking at diagrams. It isn't just print. We've set dip switches on circuit boards, looking at the diagrams, and you can't translate those into Braille. the idea is that the Opticon gave you a one-to-one representation of what was on the page. If it was a line, you saw a line. It didn't do any interpreting. You're the intelligent character recognition engine, not it. And I think that was its strength. And I think that when people want it redesigned, they want it to do OCR and so on, it kills the initial concept. Yeah, we do need some sort of a portable scanner and some way to even more easily, quickly read small pieces of paper. But we also need the versatility of looking at things that you can't stick in something or you can't put on the scanner. And that's what the Opticon does.
So presumably, if the thing breaks, there's no way to get them fixed. Is that right?
That is correct. I'm trying to think. I believe there is a fellow in Los Angeles that has a lot of the old parts from TSI. And we could dig up his name somewhere. But this was like 5-6 years ago where they can do it repaired. Now, the other thing, we have found that the battery specifications aren't that difficult. And we've helped several people get new rechargeable batteries for it. And they're cheap. I mean, we're talking $20 or whatever. And TSI used to charge you 200 and some odd to replace the battery. And it can be done for 20.
Well, that's a remarkable testimony to how useful it is. And it still surprises me, small though the market may be, that they aren't being redeveloped and supported still.
Yeah, I mean, we feel that way.
Yeah.
What we've done is just whenever we see one for sale, we're just trying to collect enough to last our lifetime. Because we can't picture what it would be like. I'd say at least 2 or 3 times a week, we'll ask ourselves, how do you do this if you can't use the Opticon? You have to wait.
Interesting. And so how did you move from being an enthusiastic, perhaps initially cautious, but ultimately enthusiastic adopter of technology to selling technology?
One of those people that I get kind of bored on the same job after a while, and I had been doing television and radio for 14 years, and we got the information through speech system from Maryland Computer Services to be used on my job at work at agriculture. And I somehow just, you know, got bitten by the bug and realized that there might be something out there in terms of training and selling, and that I wanted my own company. So I bailed out of agriculture. I'd been with the government now for 7 years. And started up my own business, and probably it was a very foolish move because I didn't have the money to do it. I had to take all the money out of retirement eventually to keep going because after 3 months I was out of money. And it was two things saved me. It was the Dectalk box and coming up with the idea. I remember walking on a bike path coming back from downtown where I'd been doing some training and thinking that what we need is some way to inform people about developments in technology. And since I was doing stuff for National Public Radio, I thought, why not do a National Public Radio style, like All Things Considered, magazine with musical bridges and so on. And so that's when the original concept for NewsBits came up, and NewsBits never changed. It was always that type of format with the musical bridges and, you know, an upbeat start. And I always used NPR standards as, you know, this is how I want it to sound. And so the other thing that happened, and anybody who's thinking of starting their own company should really be careful of this too, because I got burned. And I've talked to other people who've retired and gone into their own business, and they've been burned exactly the same way. When you are working and you say, I'd like to start up my own business, I think I'm going to do some training and so on, everybody says, oh, we got all kinds of things for you. I've got lots of people I'll send you. You know those people disappear when you when you need
yeah.
them? All of a sudden, oh, I can keep you busy for weeks just doing training. They come up with one or two, and you really have to make it on your own selling.
Ain't that the truth?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I want to talk at length about Newsbiz, but before we get there, how did the Deck Talk box help to save you?
All of the time that I've had my own company, fortunately, I've had a reasonably decent sense of spotting something that I like and that I can sell. Same thing happened for when I had the company. I sold the Kurzweil KPR, Kurzweil Personal Reader.
Mm.
When that came out in, 87?
That was amazing, that thing. You turned it on and it sounded like it was about to take off somewhere.
Yeah,
you
know, but it was better than anything else there. I read books with it.
Yeah.
Because...
And the adventure game. Did you ever find Special Command 21?
No, I never did.
Oh, if you
now remember, this is the newer one. This is the one that had the scanner and the upright box, and you also could have a camera with it.
Okay, I can't remember which ones had the special commands built in, and you could type the special command key in a couple of digits to get it to do different things.
That might have been the older unit,
yeah.
You know, the great big one that looked like it was made out of a couple of portable refrigerators.
But if you typed Special Command 21, you got the original classic text adventure game.
Hmm.
Great.
Oh, I used to love that on the computer. We used to play that on the old CPM machines with the Echo PC voice.
Yeah. Well, you know, they gave it to the library here, the library at the School for the Blind. Somebody donated, and in New Zealand dollars, it was a huge price tag to get this machine. And we quickly discovered, just because kids will do these things, just go through every single special command.
Mm-hmm.
And we found Adventure, and that was the end of using it for scanning, you know.
Well, I love those games. No,
anyway.
Yeah, that's not the one I used to sell, because
right.
that one, I think, sold for something like $50,000 U.S., and I guess the current rate, that'd be about $120,000 New Zealand.
Yes.
We... No, this was a unit that had three prices. I think it was 8, 10, and 12. And you would be surprised, at least in the Washington area, how many times we would show that unit and somebody would say, oh, let me write you a check.
Mm.
Yes, we talk about 70% of the blind population is unemployed. However, there are some blind people making very good money. And they don't necessarily have to be in high-paying jobs, but they've saved all their life because they didn't have to buy cars. The other thing, though, back to the Deck Talk, that was another item when I got a chance to see it at a convention in Philadelphia in 1984. I thought, I can sell that. I love the sound of that thing.
Mm.
And it's a fun unit because you can program it, you can make it sing. It's really an amazing unit. And it was Don Breda, who at that time, now he's with Duxbury, but he worked for National Braille Press, who, when I got the Deck Talk from him, because he had a demo model from Digital Equipment Corp., that's where Deck comes from.
Oh.
And I got it, and I said, now what do I do with this thing? And I called Don Breda, who was an outstanding teacher, and he talked me through setting it up and told me what I could do with it. And I started carrying a Deck Talk around, and it sold like hotcakes. And that saved my business.
And it's still around. I don't know what you think of the very latest version of the Deck Talk software, but I don't think it sounds as good as it used to.
Oh, I've been very disappointed in it. I purchased it, because I've always... I mean, you know, this is an interesting thing. I've taken different high-end type speech things back in the 80s to different user groups and so on and let them listen and got their reaction. Women seem to like the what was it called, Speech Plus, the board from TSI and so on. And men tend to like deck talk. It was a real gender thing. I think the Speech Plus had a take care of me sound. And but even on the tutorials that I did, I used a modified deck talk voice. That was the other thing, is that with deck talk, you could reprogram it and create your own voice. And you had parameters like head size, breathiness, roughness, smoothness, coarse pitch, tone, a lot of parameters you could set to shape the voice to what you wanted.
And it just doesn't have that flexibility now in terms of the software, and the default voices just don't sound like they used to, you know.
They don't, and they don't perform like they used to, right. Because like any software speech, they're dependent on the operation of the computer itself. I know on the list they've talked about, like, the speech stuttering.
Yes.
And, I mean, you know, a device connected serially to the computer seldom stutters, because it's not affected by drive access and so on, while a software speech is affected by everything else going on in the computer.
And so, NewsBits, was it called NewsBits originally? Has it always been called that?
It was always called NewsBits. It was a lot of fun to do, and the irony is that we're doing the interview here because over 25% of those who listen to NewsBits were from New Zealand. Yeah, because Mary Schnackenberg with the Foundation for the Blind here and the library services, I actually think she did it out of her own pocket, paid for enough of a license so that they could copy and distribute NewsBits in New Zealand. And so I had over 100 subscribers down here. The interesting thing is that you mentioned NewsBits, and when we were touring the South Island, we went to Christchurch last week and had a very pleasant afternoon at Pulse Data.
Yep.
And the first thing they brought up was NewsBits, not 508 or anything else that I'm dealing with, but NewsBits, because that's the association that people here have with me. You know, when I get introduced to anything in the States now, it's always, well, he works the Access Board and is involved in 508. Here, whenever I meet anybody, it's, oh, he used to do NewsBits.
Yeah, well, it was a pioneering kind of audio publication, and you see the production values were always superb.
Well, I mean, that wasn't an accident. That was something I actually focused on. I spent a lot of money on very expensive, and it was expensive in those days, to get good equipment to do over-the-phone interviews.
I tell you what, some of those recordings you got were full of bass, you know, really good phone patch you must have had there.
Well, I had a phone patch. I also had a very good equalizer that I used to transfer and work on the audio before I actually finished it.
Yes, great stuff. And so would you record the masters on Open Reel?
Is that yes, I always did Open Reel because that's how I edit. Oh. I used to edit basically razor blade technique, although when I went to work at agriculture, somebody there in the radio department showed me a device that a retired ABC sound engineer had built, called the Nagy, N-A-G-E-Y, tape splicer. And it was an amazing little gadget, and I still have one. I went and bought it. Funny story there, too. The guy was retired, and he lived in a fancy house in McLean, Virginia, where they only have fancy houses. And I went there one night. I had called him, and yes, I was going to come look at it and buy it. And I knocked on the door, and I had my guide dog with me, and I knocked on the door, and he opened it up, and he said, "Oh, we're retired. We don't give to anybody anymore." I said, "Excuse me, I've come to buy." Oh, he's very embarrassed. But he's died, and I believe that he had it patented, and his wife held on to the patent and wouldn't sell it, because I know some people at NPR tried to see if they could get some models made. But that really saved me for editing, because it was like a, what is it called? Do you know that it was I want to say a Queen Anne splicer. There used to be this gizmo that was made out of plastic, and you could lay the tape in grooves and slide this little unit up on a cover and cut the tape side to side.
Okay.
And but this one was much better. It was made out of steel. It had two different cutting arms. It had a holder for the tape, and you move the tape forward. It laid it perfectly in the track over the splice, and and then you cut off the tape, and it automatically pulled out just the right amount for the next splice. And so I did all mine on quarter-inch tape for, I didn't stop using quarter-inch tape until I started using Fast Edit in the mid-90s.
Mm. And the format of Newsbits was pretty consistent. There'd always be the market news section at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'd sort of go on and do feature articles about new products. I mean, you were there when, you covered all the big stories of the time, Flipper and Vocalize and ASAP and all of those things.
Yeah, we tried to stay on top of it, and some of the projects are still going on. I did an interview with Neil Scott, who is the man that's behind the Archimedes project at Stanford University. This was the idea of having an infrared link between your own portable device that had your access software on it, and you just went up to a computer that had the same infrared link, ideal for students because they could go to different computers and access it.
Yep.
And, of course, the problem is it still doesn't get around how do you handle the GUI interface in terms of the output, but they do have the input link. But, Lord, I did an interview with him back in, like, 88 or 87, and they were working on the project then. And it's still going on 15 years later with no final conclusion.
But do you have the complete set of Newsbits archives?
No. Sorry. Somebody gave me, because they were moving, and a woman in Virginia gave me her complete set, because I developed a thing where I right up front, you got a case that would hold 12 copies. And so they would get, you know, as the year went on, you'd fill in your case.
Right.
And this person had kept several years of it.
Because it's of enormous historical value and interest now. You know, it's a chronology of what went on in the assistive technology industry during that period.
As well as mainstream. Remember, I covered a lot of mainstream stuff, too. For example, or mainstream stuff that was of interest specifically to us. I remember doing several features at the very beginning of the 90s on CD-ROMs.
Yes, yes.
And when those first became available. I remember doing stuff on recording MIDI at the very beginning when this was just becoming popular. I did one that I thought was very good. Many people did, and some people said it was boring as heck. I don't regret it at all. I found a guy in Oregon that worked for some magazine who actually gave a special rate for blind people to access the magazine electronically. And I did a couple of interviews with him. One was on what to look for and so on when buying a modem and how they worked. And we talked about error correction in the modem versus the software and all of this. And then we also did an interesting one on hard disks and hard disk maintenance. I mean, we were getting pretty esoteric in terms of the computer stuff with those. So we'd have interviews like that, as well as we would have, one of my favorites was the interview that I did with the guy that wrote a book about, what was it? What version of DOS? I want to say 3.2 or 5, might have been 5, I can't even remember his name. They brailled his book at the Library of Congress, and he was so excited about it that he has in his house now, apparently, a copy of the 12-volume Braille book. But, yeah, that was a very interesting interview that I did. That was like 91 or 92. I remember where I was that I did it. And it was, oh, he was very big on PC-DOS or MS-DOS at that time.
You had a very interesting tour one time of the Source, which was the an online service.
And of course,
the big news that the Source had ultimately merged with CompuServe. That was a bit of an issue at the time.
Yes. I did several of those. You remember, also, I interviewed somebody at Prodigy.
Yeah.
And one person finally decided he was going to make Prodigy accessible, and it was Ned Johnson,
ISOS.
Of Freedom One.
Yeah.
That worked on making CompuServe, the Source. Correction. Prodigy, we'll get it sooner or later, accessible.
Yes, that was an interesting screen reader, the old ISOS. Very unorthodox, but it worked with Prodigy, all right?
Yeah, Ned, I don't know what happened to him. He was, in the category of almost a good friend, and he got very angry at me once because I did an interview with him, and he made claims as many, and it's not just him, but this is a problem of marketing sometimes. Assistive technology developers often make claims that many of us know just aren't quite true. Like, we're the only ones that do this. We're the only ones that do that. And lots of times it's just because they don't realize that there are some commands in other programs that'll do the same thing. And so I made that comment after he had made some very strong comments about his software was the only one that did this. And I knew darn well that the Arctic software did the same thing. And that I think Softvert did some of the same things. And so I just said that, sometimes some of the vendors do get carried away and don't realize that there are competing features in other products that will do the same, but this is Ned's point of view. Oh, he got mad at me.
Yes, I had some dealings with him, and he seemed to feel that, why his screen reader was being somehow deliberately overlooked.
Yeah. And some people really got upset about that. And then a name we know well, who I still consider a friend, Ted Henter,
yes,
wrote me a letter once that just about burned the envelope before I got there, and I doubt if he even remembers it. But I had done an interview with Dolphin Systems.
Oh, yeah.
And I'll never forget it, because all the way through I called it Falcon.
I remember that.
Yes, I had to send out a correction. But I gave him a very free hand to go ahead and describe what they did. And it was partly Ted's letter that prompted me to make the statement after Ned's interview, because Ted wrote and basically said, "We think you have over-exaggerated what the Falcon or Dolphin system can do, and here's a lot of things it can't do that they're claiming." And I said, "Okay, I did not make any claims; only Dolphin did. But Ted may be right that maybe some disclaimer afterwards needs to be put in saying that this is These are the vendors talking, and they're the ones making the claims, and Newsbits is not verifying them.
Henter Joyce was going through a bit of an era like that at the time, too, because they wrote that rather controversial comparison of JAWS versus WindowEye, versus Vocalize, and sort of touted it as fact, whereas it was actually sort of very aggressive marketing hype, and it got Henter Joyce quite offside with a lot of people. But
actually,
it was,
I don't even think it... You think it was Vocalize?
Yeah,
I don't think Vocalize was around then.
Well, maybe the JAWS-Vocalize comparison came a little after this event.
The
then,
big row, the absolute granddaddy of all rows, talk about history, was the program that I started selling called the Enhanced PC Talking Program. Now, the Enhanced PC Talking Program was interesting because there wasn't a PC Talking Program. We immediately went to the Enhanced. And this was from Computer Conversations, which was a company owned, run, et cetera, by a guy by the name of Ron Hutchinson in Ohio. And I guess the event you're talking about probably was after this, because this was a row between TSI and Computer Conversations, where TSI had written a comparison and circulated a document among its own salespeople for the salespeople to use. It wasn't supposed to be a public document, and it got out.
As these things inevitably do.
Right. And, oh, it was a row. Oh. And to this day, I will say that in its time, Ron's program, hands down, did the job. It was very good for, but we're going way back, Jonathan. This is when we had PC Speaks.
Yep.
And Computer Conversations and Freedom Ones. What did they call theirs originally? Do you remember?
It was something before it was ISOS. But
It was something to do with Freedom One, or maybe that was the name of the program.
Oh. Yeah, I forget now.
But there were some good fights in the middle of the 80s and so on. I think the industry has matured a little bit. I guess, you know, you're covering it all the time, so you're probably much more in tune with the politics of the assistive technology industry. But, there were some rows in the 80s.
Yeah, and you have to take care to be balanced and accurate, obviously. We very seldom get vendors or manufacturers coming to us asking for some sort of correction. Obviously, if one is necessary, we're happy to make one. But it's a challenge, isn't it? It's also a challenge when, because the industry is so small, if there's a story which you feel needs to be broken with respect to maybe quality control issues or some other issue, you do take a bit of a risk in determining is it serious enough to actually risk covering it.
Well, and you're right. And not only are you risking the relationship with the vendor, which may or may not be something that you should value, if you have a bad relationship with the vendor, suddenly you'll find yourself outside the news. You won't know what's going on. But the other thing that's particular with this industry especially is that each vendor has a very, very strong, devoted group of users.
Yes.
And if you alienate the vendor, you've also alienated the users. Whether you're right or wrong, the users are going to be mad at you for picking on their company.
Yes, there's real passion about screen access software in particular. There was also an issue that came up, I think, on some of the early CompuServe forums. People felt there may be a conflict of interest if you were a vendor as well as producing a program like NewsBits. How did you deal with that?
I got into some controversy with that. The classic, probably, that kicked that off was, yes, I had NewsBits, but NewsBits couldn't support somebody. You just absolutely cannot sell. You know, I never got the NewsBits subscription, including the 100 down here, over 450.
Oh.
That you can't make money on. So you got to sell something or do something. And I did some training, but we also sold. And nobody seemed to care when I was selling the KPR. Where we got into trouble was selling the PC KPR. This was the software base, and at that time, Jim Fruchterman had just started up
Arkenstone
as a non-profit arm of Calera. And I tried to be honest about the different features of both, and I did do articles on the Arkenstone. I think even then it was called was it Open Book?
I think it
was a closed book.
Oh, they had something, didn't they, before? Was it? Oh, I can't remember.
I can't remember.
Maybe it's always been Open Book.
Yeah, I think so. And then they had Open Book Unbound. That's what it was.
Right.
Yeah, Open Book was the first. And they were very, in many ways, they were similar systems. Although the Open Book tended to be more of a dedicated program that you used your computer basically for that. While the PCKPR was more of an application that you ran after you booted up. What got me in trouble was I made the comment after a particular conference. This was in 1985, I believe. Might have been later. There was some interest among several blind lawyers as to how a non-profit company could sell products through profit-making companies. In other words, Arkenstone, as a non-profit company, was selling its products through private vendors who were, you know, raising the price 25-30%. And the issue came up of the legality of a non-profit company doing that. And so I mentioned that on NewsBits. I should have kept my mouth shut.
Yeah, but, you know, and that's the dilemma, isn't it? Because there are news stories out there. We had an issue with this when Freedom Scientific was going through quite a bit of upheaval, as mm-hmm. is quite natural when you have an organization that has been merged, and there will be staff changes and policy changes that upset people. So we got lots of information, and the question was, what information is actually in the public interest, and what information is just gossip? Mm-hmm. And so that's always a difficult judgment call to make. And in the end, we ran the material that we felt was in the public interest and left the other stuff.
We thought you did a very good job, by the way. I heard that, and I thought it was handled very well, very professionally.
Well, I appreciate that, because it's as you'll know, when you get stories like that, it's an agonizing thing to deal with, to get the mix right.
Yeah, and it's very, very difficult to keep your own personal biases. You just have to keep them out. And this is why I probably would have said exactly the same thing that I did about Arkenstone, whether I had been selling PCKPRs at their competitor or not.
Right.
But the fact that I was selling it slanted people's perception of my view.
Because journalism is a discipline, and you just simply separate Doug Wakefield, the journalist, from Doug Wakefield, the vendor.
Yeah, you have to.
Right.
And that gets very difficult when sometimes you may be reporting on something that's going to hurt your own income.
Yeah. And were you in that position at times?
Yeah. And this is one of the conflicts, and I would go ahead and report it and take the lumps, because if I thought a product came out that was really better than mine, that I was selling, because I didn't develop any products except for the tutorials and news bits, I would go ahead and cover it. And my problem was that I would also lose enthusiasm for selling mine. I'd rather sell theirs, because some people can sell anything. They really can. I'll sell you a used car that's been through a flood. But I'm the sort of person that I can't really sell it unless I think it is the best. And I have to really like it. Otherwise, there's no way I can convince somebody else that it's a good idea. And so if I was selling something, this happened, I was selling a Braille printer that'll remain nameless, it was a good printer. I just didn't like it very much, partially because it was so heavy to carry around to show people. But another company came out with a one that I just liked a lot better. And I lost all my enthusiasm for selling the one that I was selling. A very, very, very fickle reseller, you see. I like to stick with what I think is the winner.
Yeah, but in a way, that's what people look for. In my own company, which I'm now in the process of kind of scaling back because of new full-time ACB radio commitments, we actually chose never to sell anything and simply to make money based on recommending and training, so that you couldn't be accused of being bought by different levels of commission or by recommending just what it is that you're selling. And I think people look for that. They want to know what's the best, not what is the best for someone's pocketbook.
Yeah, I agree that when you are selling something, it's almost impossible not to look like, if you're doing a, you know, news bits or main menu or blind line or whatever, if you're doing any reporting and you're selling, you're suspect. And I think the ideal is, as you say, is to avoid selling. And I would. I would prefer to do, if I was to do it over again, come up with a way. This is why I like the tutorials. The tutorials did not cause any conflict that I produced. And I used to do some online, not online, but on-location training. Now there's a much bigger need than there was. Well, there's people are more eager to pay for training now than they were in the 80s.
You know, we were looking at the Freedom Box just before the interview, and I seem to recall you did something on NewsBits where you talked to a computer.
I was thinking of that as you were demonstrating this, you know, the Freedom Box. I think it was called the Companion.
Yeah.
And
that's right, because you'd say Companion, and it would wake up. You
yes.
Know, yeah.
And I remember doing the interview. This was in 89. And they were going around the government showing it. And it was much more limited than this one, primarily because it didn't have an online service. You know, the Freedom Box expects you to be online. This was a completely standalone unit that did have dial-up capabilities to call and so on. But it also would call people using your regular telephone. I mean, this is pre web days.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. The tutorials, was the DOS one your first one?
Yes. And
with Mechanical Max.
Mechanical Max. Yeah. I did the DOS one twice. I recorded it and sold it and decided that there were some changes that really ought to be made, and sold a lot of those after I redid them. It was a very popular one. And then what I would do is when people bought, say, a news WordPerfect or Lotus, we would give them a real good deal if they bought the, you know, bundle the DOS one with it.
Okay. When you produced the DOS one, it occurred to me that what initially your plan seems to be was to also make this relevant to a market bigger than the blind community.
That was an idea. It was a flop, but it was an idea, and it didn't work. Primarily, people want to read. I mean, I remember I had conversations with the producers of FlipTrack, and I will confess now that whenever I started a tutorial, the first thing I did was buy FlipTrack and go through those, because they were good. And they did rely on print, but it would give me a good basic understanding of the program before I actually started reading the manual. I always feel that manuals are for people who already know something about the program. It's very hard to start learning a program from a manual.
Yeah.
But yeah, the idea was that it was going to be a tutorial that you could listen to in your car or whatever. I had heard these different training tapes say that real estate people listen to as they're going for their license and so on. I thought, you know, this would be a good idea. Took a lot more money than I had to launch something like that. It really would.
It's a shame, because that whole concept, learn a foreign language, all kinds of things that people learn while they're in the commute, you know, it has potential.
Yeah, I even tried to go broader with NewsBits. Not with NewsBits itself, but tried to do a parallel in terms of a listen-to technical magazine. And I did a pilot, and I hired a consultant, and I worked with a graphics design company. I think we put about $20,000 into it. Fortunately or unfortunately, of other people's money that, you know, over the last years had to be paid back because they were you know, basically investments. But it would have taken more than that. It was like launching a real magazine. And we didn't have the expertise, and we didn't have the capitalization.
I don't know whether you find this, but I found that when you're trying to produce a tutorial or even a comprehensive run-through of a program, the best way to do it is to record it, and when you get stuck, figure out why you're stuck and keep going.
Mm-hmm.
that you actually, you can't produce these things until you start them, and then you find out what you don't know.
Oh, that's true. And you have to know it well enough to keep right on going. You can't do something and stop and think about, now let's say I'm going to learn the next. So before you can do a tutorial, I think you do have to know the program pretty well.
Mm.
But my tutorials were all, I don't know if I'd say impromptu or ad lib. They were not written down. People would want transcripts of them. And there was no transcript.
Mm.
I figured that it took me an hour recording, about a 2-to-1 ratio, because I edited like crazy.
Yeah.
I edited out my mistakes, my coffee drinking, my cussing at my computer, and got it, you know, edited it down to a tutorial that made it sound like I knew what I was talking about. But if you ever heard the original, you'd wonder how I ever got the tutorial out of it. Sort of a funny aside, I got a call from a fellow in England when I was doing the tutorials, and he wanted to know if was it RNIB could sell them, and I said, sure. And he said, do you mind if we translate them into English? And yes, I'm from the northeast corner of the country, from Vermont, and I probably have a Vermont accent, but I didn't think it was that different.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing how that goes on. I was spending some time in New York three years ago now, and the children were getting bored, and we turned on the TV in the apartment, and there were the Teletubbies, which you may not be familiar with, but it's
no.
a program for toddlers.
Oh.
It's an English program. And, you know, we see this here in New Zealand, but in the States, the Teletubbies had been overdubbed with American voices.
Hmm.
There's a lot of it, and I hear from people in RNIB land that when they get talking books from American sources with American readers, they get a lot of complaints that there are Americans on there. Fun, isn't it?
Well, there was an American on the tutorials.
Yeah.
They wanted to translate it.
Yeah, but you must have had particular challenges, because these days, thank goodness, a lot of the documentation is online, built into the program, and print manuals are a bit of a rarity. But then the I still remember the massive manual that you got with your copies of WordPerfect for DOS. It was this massive binder of documentation. So you must have had challenges in terms of really coming to grips with a powerful package like WordPerfect to the point that you could produce, I think it was like an 8-cassette tutorial on it.
Yeah, it was a challenge. The ones that I had the most satisfaction out of doing, WordPerfect I used all the time too.
Yeah.
And so I don't remember the learning process, but the two that I really had to learn because I didn't use myself, DBase 3 Plus and Lotus 1-2-3. And when I started the Lotus, I had no idea what a spreadsheet was like, what you could do with it. I mean, when I got the tutorial done, I was very happy with it, and I used Lotus a lot. But it was a foreign concept to me. DBase, same way. DBase was a little bit like learning to ride a bike. It took a long time to just get tuned into the program and how it functioned. As one person said to me, DBase is like, you know, on-the-fly programming. The commands don't make sense necessarily. And that one, I had to sit down and I read the 2-volume print manual cover to cover with the Opticon. That's the only way I could do it. And Lotus, I did the same thing. I read the manual with the Opticon and looked at pictures of spreadsheets with the Opticon, and really learned them very well, and felt like, personally, I had accomplished something just learning the blooming things well enough to do the tutorial. So it depended on the program, whether I used it or not. I did a ProCom one.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I didn't have to read the manual there because I used it.
Mm. Gosh, all those communications programs. Yeah, ProCom was big. There was Telex as well, which was a pretty big rival in the BBS community.
Oh, yeah, and this is when I began to say, I don't know if I want to stay in this market, because it's when I did the ProCom one, and at the same time, oh, there was a point where I raised the price of NewsBits.
Yes.
And I started getting nasty letters talking about not only was I overcharging for this rag, but the company obviously didn't know what they were doing because they were doing stuff on ProCom instead of Telex. And I said, wait a minute. We don't need this much emotion over a software program.
Well, see, this was, of course, the real beginning of the blind online era.
Mm-hmm.
And we've done a lot of coverage of this recently with Willie Wilson's death.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because people would get on. I remember the thread, the ongoing, seemingly eternal thread on Blink Talk about the increase to the price of NewsBits.
Mm-hmm.
And all the vitriol that...
Oh, yeah. And I just said, hey, but I will say in sort of a personal satisfaction, a couple of my most vocal, what do you call them, detractors?
Mm-hmm.
I know that they decided to start their own after I stopped NewsBits, and they never did. And one of the fellows, who will remain nameless, actually called and apologized and said, I had no idea how hard it was to do. It was time-consuming. That was the main thing. And cost of living was going up. Our rents were going up in the offices. And I hadn't raised the price of NewsBits in, I don't know, 2 or 3 years. And... there are very few products that you can get, you know, year after year at exactly the same price. It just doesn't happen.
The blind community can be pretty tough at times, don't you think?
Oh, as I've heard somebody say several times, nobody is harder on blind people than other blind people.
Why is that?
Beats me. I mean, I don't know. We'll kill each other. And not only that, but... we will be more critical. I think part of it is we feel that what somebody else does to some extent reflects on us. Almost like the concept of the Japanese family, that when you go out of the family and do something, you're still representing the family, and everything you do reflects back on the family. Well, I think the blind community is a little bit like this, that when we see somebody doing something, you know, we'll say, boy, they're a lousy blind person. Because they, you know, whether it's their skills that we think are bad or their social behavior, something that we find embarrassing. And we might be critical of anybody with 20/20, but we don't get as, doesn't reflect personally on us. That's just my guess. I haven't really thought that much about it. The other thing is that the online stuff has really had an interesting psychological phenomena associated with it. excuse me, a little bit like answering machines. I remember somebody called me up and just reamed me out on my answering machine. And I grabbed that phone and I called him right back and I said, Nick. It happened to be a guy named Nick. I said, what the blazes are you doing? Oh, I'm sorry. People will not talk to you the way they will online or on an answering machine. When it's sort of like road rage. You know, you're in a car, people are driving, and the meekest person will become a real tiger because they feel protected. I think we do that online sometimes. We let loose online in ways that we would never do on a face-to-face conversation.
Well, you can adopt a persona online, can't you?
Oh, yes. 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 I guess people do. I hadn't thought of it that way, but, oh, yeah.
You know,
is it a persona, or are they their real self coming out?
One, I don't know. I mean, what's to stop me from setting up a Yahoo account and pretending to be an attractive 25-year-old female?
I have heard of people doing, not men, but I have heard of women doing that. The problem is you don't ever want to meet the person.
Well, no.
Unless you are a 25-year-old attractive woman. Major disappointments sometimes really tick people off.
Yeah. We have an expression in New Zealand, and one of the things I've learned about this global project on which I'm involved, of course, is the linguistic differences.
Mm-hmm.
We did a program a couple of weeks ago, or I attempted to, about bicycles on footpaths, and it didn't dawn on me until about 25 minutes into the program that the reason why I wasn't getting any reaction was because I didn't say sidewalks.
Exactly. A footpath. We were talking about this morning at breakfast. A footpath generally means through the woods, like a bike path.
Right.
But it's for walking.
Yeah.
And the sidewalk is a sidewalk. It's not a footpath.
Well, yeah. But you see, when we were in New York, we found that they call what we would call roads pavements, and what we call pavements, you call sidewalks. So it all gets very confusing.
Yes, it does.
But the point is, how do we get onto that? Oh, yeah, that we have an expression in New Zealand, which I don't think is used anywhere else, called the tall poppy syndrome. And basically what it means is that if you somehow stand out from the crowd, if you're doing something that's a bit out of the ordinary, then you're also under a bit of scrutiny and probably attack because of that as well. And maybe that's what happened in the case of Newsbits. It was done very well. It was pretty pioneering at the time. And so people wanted to either imitate it or see it fall down.
Yeah, I think there is some of that. And we see that in any community, not just, quote, the blind community, that, you know, if you are, quote, as you said, on top or whatever, people are going to start shooting at you.
There you go. Now, so why is that part of the reason why Newsbits wound down in the tutorials?
Oh, there's a couple of things. Primarily, Newsbits, even with the price increase, never increased in circulation. I mean, I know, and everybody knows, there was an awful lot of duplication where people would, you know, buy one copy and send it off to friends.
Mm.
And sure, I'm sure I've been just as guilty as the next person of doing that. But that's not how you support an effort that you happen to like. And so one, we just couldn't make money. Two, it was burning up too much time. And three, in all honesty, I didn't, for the amount of effort, I didn't want any more of that sort of negative feedback. And from a very practical standpoint, I'd taken a job, I finally went back to the government and said, I need to make a living. And so I got a job back in radio for a while, and then went to a computer information technology accessibility lab for the General Services Administration. And there I would have been in quite a conflict, especially being a government employee, demonstrating technologies and assistive technology, and then reviewing it on Newsbits. It looked like a very sticky wicket. And so I decided that, you know, Newsbits at 400 copies wasn't paying much, but GSA was willing to pay, you know, $60,000 a year. You go where your bread and butter is.
Sure. But it's really Newsbits that, I suppose, established your credentials, and do you think may have had a significant contributing factor towards being where you are now with the Access Board?
Truthfully, no.
You don't think so?
Newsbits is much better known outside the country than within the U.S.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes, we had some very, very devoted readers. Probably what got me to where I am now, actually, in terms of being, you know, the lead person on the 508 technical standards and doing the training on it, had more to do with my work at the General Services Administration within the government and giving presentations there. Got to remember that a lot of this is you're hired by people who only know you in your what your background is, and they're often cited people who have never heard NewsBits, never heard the tutorial, wouldn't have a clue what I was doing in the 80s, but they know what I did in the 90s.
Right.
And that's how I got the current position.
How do you rate the current state of access that blind people have to the computer? Because, I think NewsBits was still around when people were starting to panic about what the future of access was when the Windows era was beginning and DOS was clearly on the wane.
I remember giving a talk in 1989 in Richmond, Virginia, at the ACB convention. And this was at the very beginning of the panic. And I remember saying then that yes, it looks threatening and so on, but I am absolutely convinced that ingenuity will overcome whatever problems there are and that we will continue to have access. And I think now, in many ways, our access to services, to different online services, the internet, to the Windows operating system, is much more powerful than we ever enjoyed in the 80s in DOS. I think it's much better.
Me too. We tend to have a tendency in our community to romanticize the good old days a bit. But, give me the ability to go into an application and tap the alt key and find out what's in the menus.
Yes.
The fact that, you'll remember you had to set up your brand new printer to work with WordPerfect. And then when that was done, you'd go into DBase and have to set up your printer for that
again.
And then you'd go into Lotus and do it. It was ridiculous.
I used to, when I was doing demos back in the early 90s, what I used to do is I would run, I'd show different DOS applications and so on. And the only really scary thing that happened, and it's probably in what people don't realize, we're darn lucky Windows came along. People were moving towards a graphical interface.
People forget that.
And the graphical interface, for a while, was not consistent. I used to bring up this CD-ROM recipe generating program at the end of my demo and say, now who can tell me how to get out of this? And to this day, nobody. If you didn't read the manual, you could not figure out how to exit that program without shutting the computer down because nothing was consistent. And we had no access to it because everybody was writing their own protocols as to how they were writing to the screen. And that was the only time I think access really got threatened, was when people were writing their own GUIs that were DOS-based.
Even WordPerfect 6 had that. You could have a sighted person using the same computer and they'd put it into graphics mode and the thing just would not talk. And if you didn't know how to put the command line at the end to switch it back to text mode, you were in trouble.
That happened to me not too long ago. Yeah. I still use DOS 6.2. I love it. I've just moved to XP and probably that's the end of DOS 6.2.
Yes.
But in 98 and so on, I had very good DOSBox access and ran WordPerfect all the time. And I did that just about 6 months ago. I went to do some command, and I didn't hit, I don't even remember what I hit. It was like Alt F3 or something. I went to, and I hit Control F3 or something. And I flipped it into graphics mode. I didn't have a clue what I had done. Hmm. I finally just had to crash the machine. I couldn't get out. And I had forgotten about that graphics mode.
See, it's like people who forget to leave the seat up.
Yeah, right.
But that's interesting because you're quite positive about the state of Windows access. So why have you not yet migrated to the wonderful Word of Word and all that sort of stuff?
Because you can't beat the speed. of you can't beat the speed of programs running in DOS when they will do the job for you. And with WordPerfect 6.2 in DOS, it was much faster. The Braille access, and I'm a very, very diehard, ardent Braille user when it comes to writing. I have not seen good Braille output for word processing in Windows. That's the one area that I think that DOS, it's sort of ironic. In DOS, we used to have very good access to being able in Braille to look at formatting and so on in a word processor, but many of the other programs were very difficult, like online programs, and Lotus took a lot of work to get the screen readers running with it and so on. Now in Windows, it turns out that actually showing text the way it is on the screen in Braille is a lot more challenging than running many of the other applications like Internet Explorer. I think Word takes more work than Internet Explorer on the part of the script and set file programmers.
The whole question of refreshable Braille interests me in the US context. I went to the World Blind Union General Assembly in Melbourne in 2000, and, you know, Papa Mai were there, and I think Alvar were there, and all those people. And I can't remember which manufacturer I got talking to, but they showed me their latest Braille display, and it was something like $11,000. I think it might have been an 80-character one.
Yeah.
And the guy said to me, in a country like Sweden, a kid who might be, you know, 10 or 11, is going to have one of these at home and one of these at school. And it's mind-boggling. Really? That because of the cost of Braille access in many countries, Braille is under, I think, serious threat as we move to a world of less hard copy, generally. They can't get their hands on Braille displays.
Yeah, it also has to do with the overall, because of the price, it has a lot to do with the whole concept of the government of a country as to what is the role of the individual and what is the role of the government in providing certain things. In the U.S., the rehabilitation services, which would be, you know, varies from state to state, even though there is a federal rehabilitation type office that does a lot of giving out grants and so on to states. It varies from state to state as to how the program works, but the focus is generally on career only. And if you're employed, and I've actually heard this from quote, rehab counselors, that if you're on the job and you're doing it well, why do we need to buy you any equipment? You're already doing the job. You're employed. And so the idea of quality of life generally doesn't enter into it. But there is an interesting contrast that somebody should debate someday, because this is terrific. One of the women in our office at the Access Board is married to a fellow from the Netherlands. He's been appalled at the lack of services and accommodations for people with visual difficulties in the U.S. versus the Netherlands. And for instance, here in New Zealand, even down in a small city like Invercargill, which is right down, as you know, but the listeners don't, right on the southern point of the Southern Island, they have accessible street crossings. They have tactile markings as you come up to a wheelchair ramp. Every place we have been in New Zealand, all through Stockholm in Sweden, in Frankfurt, Germany, in London, there are many, many, many services that are built-in features to make it easier to walk around and, quote, be independent. But apparently, because it's a take-care-of-you attitude, it is apparently very difficult for people to get, quote, mainstream jobs in the same country that's taking care of you.
Mm.
And I only know this anecdotally. I don't know if anybody's done any research on it. In the U.S., it is probably easier to get a job as a mainstream lawyer if you're blind than, say, in England, although I don't know that. But on the other hand, you're on your own if you want to go strolling through a new city and you're not sure what the traffic patterns are and so on. There's not going to be anything to help you.
Well, of course, a lot of that may have to do with some pretty strong anti-accessible pedestrian signal advocacy that's gone on in the U.S. over the years.
Yeah, I'm sure it has. I don't know if this is true in other countries or not, but, you know, the division in the blind community in the U.S. has not helped.
No. Well, and other countries just simply can't fathom. I mean, sometimes you can look at an opinion and you think, okay, well, that's a legitimate difference of philosophical view. But every other person from every other country I've spoken with don't understand why the US has a group opposed to accessible pedestrian signaling or descriptive video or those sorts of things.
Yeah, well, I mean, but we're talking about intelligent people who have their particular point of view.
Sure. But it's fascinating that it's only an issue in the U.S., isn't it?
Yeah. Again, maybe it's a healthy thing. I mean, I'm finding that, for example, I heard an issue in New Zealand that if you have a guide dog and they feel that the guide dog isn't functioning as well as it should, the guide dog school here has the authority to either make, you know, take away the support that you can't use the dog or you shouldn't take it into any public places because it's no longer authorized as a guide dog.
Mm.
Now, in the U.S., you wouldn't do that.
Right.
I just, when I heard it, I said, I'm sorry, I could never live here. I'm a guide dog user. Nobody is going to tell me when to stop using my dog except me and the dog. We have very strong feelings about being able to proclaim our own, quote, rights in the U.S.
Yes, and obviously it's a monopoly situation here. There's only one guide dog school, and that does smack of paternalism big time. And,
yeah.
I mean, guide dog handlers are very concerned about that too. Then, of course, by contrast, you have the story that seems to be very big in the U.S. at the moment to do with the blind person who has murdered his dog.
I haven't heard this. When did this happen?
No, just in the last few days.
Oh, I haven't heard any news from the U.S. in several days.
Right, so it's...
Oh, that's terrible.
There's articles coming up all over the place about guide dog abuse and...
It does happen, and that's the downside of our approach, is that because even though the guide dog schools, you know, bring in a lot of money, you still pay a token fee. And part of that is the legal transfer, I believe, of ownership of the dog from the school to you. It is your dog.
Right.
So the school does not have any right to withdraw the dog. But because the person is blind, this is, as far as I'm concerned, this is just as much a prejudice as saying that you can't take your dog because you're blind into some place. People won't treat them like they would a sighted person who abused the dog.
Yes.
They will be more patient. They will try to avoid arresting the person. You know, he kills his dog and it's illegal. Grab him, lock him up, and throw the key away. I don't care if he's blind or not. If he's a bad person, he's a bad person.
And the question of ownership is something that the Association of Blind Citizens here is working on, because at the moment the dog here from our guide dog school belongs to the school always.
Mm.
And they sort of give you a license to use the dog.
Right.
And can revoke it, as you say.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's a frequency. Yeah. The other rather glowing analysis of New Zealand that you gave we need to kind of moderate that by saying that there is a real paucity of Braille in this country. You know, you go to, you may not have had too many experiences with hotels in New Zealand, but one of the impressive things for me as a New Zealander going to the US is the Braille on the elevators and on the room doors. You know exactly where your room number is. I don't think I have seen an hotel in New Zealand that has Braille in that way.
Oh, I'm sorry. You mean there's a shortage of Braille?
Yes.
We were surprised. We actually talked about this before we started our South Island trip. And what we found that just shocked us was, for instance, we took a cross-alpine, is that what it's called? The train that runs from Christchurch to Greymouth,
yeah,
which goes up over the hills.
So the Transalpine Express.
Transalpine Express,
yeah. Yeah.
That stopped at different places. But anyway, in the restroom was a whole lot of Braille describing how to use the changing table for children.
Seriously?
And it was molded into the plastic.
How incredible.
And it was good Braille. I mean, it was good grade 2 contraction Braille.
Well, never.
You're right. I don't think we saw any... Well, we stayed in bed and breakfast. So obviously their rooms weren't Braille. But in the one or two places that were quite large that we stayed, although they didn't have Braille numbers, they had good tactile numbers on. And again, your although it's not Braille, your street crossing signals, not only are they audible, but they generally have an arrow.
Yes.
Now, I can't say, in all honesty, that the arrow is very helpful, because it generally points straight up. Does that mean that when it starts going, you're supposed to jump as high as you can? I'm sorry, I can't go in that direction.
Yeah, they also tend to have these tactile buttons that pop out.
Oh, those are great.
Give you quite a bit of a jolt, some of them, actually.
Yeah, there's one right up here on the corner where we're staying. And I use that a lot, but the funny thing is that they don't have any audible sound. It's just, you have to kind of keep your hand on the box. When the little thing pops out, you say, okay, it's time to risk it.
Right, that's right. And I guess that that may even deal with you know, the Federation's concerns about the audible signals distracting your perception of the traffic, because if you've just got this thing popping out telling you when the light's giving you an indication to cross, you're still hearing the traffic perfectly because there's no other noise going on.
That's true.
So there you go. There's the answer.
Yeah, I like that.
And for our next step, we solve the Middle East peace crisis problem.
That's next.
I'd like to, before we run out of time, talk about Section 508, which is having worldwide implications, I think. Just the other day, I was working with a government client, and they had upgraded a piece of software which was now 508 compliant, and voila, no more, you know, complicated JAWS scripting needed. We have an international audience. We log listeners in 70 countries now. So can you just take us through what Section 508 of the Rehab Act is and does?
Okay. First of all, we had a act in 1973 called the Rehab Act that is basically the federal equivalent of the ADA, Access to Service and Programs that are financed or run are provided by the federal government. And over the years, there have been amendments to that act to add different accessibility concerns, and one of those is 508 that was actually added in 1986, but it was not enforceable. There was no enforcement that an agency had to do anything about electronic accessibility. In 1998, they put some teeth in the act and said, when an agency purchases, maintains, uses, whatever, electronic and information technology, they must assure that employees with disabilities have access to the information and data comparable to that enjoyed by people without disabilities. And then they went on to say, and when an agency provides services to the public, which is almost always the internet now, that the information and data must be as accessible to people with disabilities who are members of the public as it is to people without disabilities. And then it told the Access Board that we will write the technical standards that agencies must follow when procuring equipment so that the equipment will meet those needs. So we did that, and we're done. They have been published, and primarily 508 focuses, unlike the built environment, although the built environment, you can make a case for this, which I will mention in just a second, we focus on compatibility more than built in. Yeah, this is my influence, primarily. I'm not an advocate of what I call universal design, because often I think that's designing for the lowest common denominator. I'm more for universal flexibility, universal accessibility, meaning that it's accessible if you want to attach your own assistive technology. Not that the technology is always built in and you've got to use what the manufacturer has built in. This is actually, you know, we say, well, this isn't true in the bricks and mortar when it comes to buildings. But it is. An accessible building does not mean that a person can leave his wheelchair at the door. It means that the building accommodates the assistive technology being used by a person who has a mobility-related disability. And so our software, our web, most of our telecommunication standards, our desktop and laptop standards all have to do with either building it in if you want to. We can't say you can't. If you want to build in the accessibility, fine, or provide support for assistive technology. And support meaning, as you said, having the software so that you don't have to jump through hoops to make a specific screen reader function with it.
Now, we were talking with a couple of folks from Microsoft who came on the show late last year. A question I have for you, and it's come up a couple of times, is it would be wonderful if there was at least, a fairly fully fledged, maybe, screen reader built into the Windows operating system so that blind people didn't have to pay a premium for access to the computer. Is Windows technically not 508 compliant because it doesn't talk?
No. Windows is compliant because it provides support for assistive technology.
Right.
If you have a program, as we were talking before we were recording, if you have a website, for instance, that has all kinds of images with no text information, that's not compliant. Putting the text in to an image or associating text with the image brings it more in compliance. You don't expect the web page to download speech modules to you, take over your machine, and start talking. I'm iffy about the idea of, is it good to have Microsoft build their own screen reader? From a philosophical standpoint, I think it's unhealthy for the AT industry, but it may not be. For example, you remember IBM screen reader that worked with OS 2 and so on, and I remember talking to I guess it was somebody, one of the guys from Arctic, and they were telling me that they were chatting with the IBM folks at the IBM booth at Closing the Gap or some other place. And they asked the IBM guy, how are you guys planning to sort of, you know, break into the market with this new program? He said, well, we thought we'd put out about 20,000 free copies for people to get used to. And, you know, the market is so small, they were about to swamp the market. And they could have. But they didn't. Because people didn't want to, you know, some people used their program and loved it. Many people said, no, I want to use JAWS, I want to use Vocalize, I want to use something else. And so I don't know if there was something built in, whether people would say, well, I don't want to spend the money, I'm not going to buy it, I'm not going to buy another screen reader, I'm going to use what's in Windows.
But blind people shouldn't be any different, should they, in the sense that Windows now comes with basic defrag utilities, with CD burning even, and Windows XP. Mm-hmm. But people are still going out and buying the Norton Utilities and Easy CD Creator and things.
Yes, that's true. And that's what I'm saying, that maybe it wouldn't crush the market. Because you've always got this feeling that an independent company might do a better job than what Microsoft did with their screen reader. Now, we do have the very basic, both the magnifier and the narrator. And they're limited. And that's fine. Whether that should become a full-fledged screen reader, it's hard to say. And would that screen reader support non-Microsoft applications?
Yes, indeed. Yes. So what difference do you think 508 is tangibly making at this stage?
Okay. First of all, it's made a change that has absolutely surprised us at the board, because I think, as you know, it's a lot easier to change a web page or software than it is to change hardware.
Hmm.
Yet the people who have really, really bitten the bullet and come out with new products very rapidly, or changed products, are the people like Canon, Xerox, Osei, which are large copy manufacturers and printers and so on, and they've taken it very seriously. And these products have changed fast. I thought that it would take them a couple of years, but it didn't. And I receive email questions all the time from companies. Would it be compliant if we do this? And I write back and either say yes or no. And they take it very seriously. The software people, yes, they're beginning to move. Macromedia has been making a lot of progress, for instance. They're the producers of the web authoring tool Dreamweaver, and they're working with another company called UsableNet, and they've developed a whole set of tools that not only help you remember that you need to put in access features when you're designing web pages, but also will go through your pages before you post them on the web and help you. Once you set up like a macro, it'll make all the corrections that are necessary to a particular type of element. And this is something that has been spawned by 508. I mean, this really is a reaction to the fact that the government must have accessible websites.
It'd be a wonderful thing if we ever get to the point where most of the web development tools used won't let you even save the page until the links have alt text.
Yeah, I doubt if we'll ever get to the point where it won't save the page. Sorry, but in the U.S. we'd never say you have to, and we won't do it unless you do. What we would do is say, here are the options, it is highly recommended, and you might even get a warning. You are about to save a page that's in violation with federal standards. If you plan to post this on a federal site, you may want to make changes, but it'll still save it.
One of the good things about 508 is the accessible web guidelines, or standards, in fact. They're not guidelines, are
they're
they?
Standards.
They're standards. And I've found those, personally, at my work, a welcome alternative to other options out there, because I found that W3C has made the process far too daunting for most people. They look at those guidelines and they just think this is too hard, and somehow the 508 standards make it manageable, make it seem possible.
Well, I think there's two big differences. Number one, WAI, W3C, those are guidelines. They're not enforceable. And so they can be as broad as they would like. You can't be sued, for instance. A complaint can't be filed against you for not following WAI. And so they can have statements in there having to do with the grammar that you use or the simplest possible language. These are, you know, yeah, it's a good guideline to say don't use language that isn't necessary. However, that's why ours have to be clear, measurable, and so on, because if you don't follow them, somebody can bring an action. The other area, that's the difference between a standard and a guideline. The other thing that's very different is that because ours are, quote, enforceable, ours are a baseline. In other words, this is the minimum that you need to do. While the WAI, although they have priorities, I would say most non-informed web developers are not in a position to say, well, I'm only going to do priority one, or I'm only going to do priority two. They don't dare make that decision. So they do look at the whole thing and say, oh my God, I got to do all of these things. And while ours just say, okay, this is what you have to do. You can do more, but this is what you have to do. And we spell it right out in 16 basic requirements.
Hmm. What about hardware? You've talked about copiers and printers and things which are making progress. We've had lots of calls on various programs on ACB radio relating to cell phones, you know, because they're a useful tool. And people are a little bit dismayed that there's not been the progress that they had expected with respect to accessible cell phones. Can that actually be affected by 508? Can you claim
that? We think it will be.
Okay.
See, there are two pieces of legislation that have happened within the last 5 years or so in the U.S. One is the revision of the Telecom Act and adding in something called 255, and this happened in 96 before I joined the board. And they were given the job of writing accessible guidelines, not standards, but guidelines for telecommunications products. And the big difference here, though, is that the amount of pain, if you want to call it that, that a manufacturer is supposed to feel before they cry uncle and say we can't do this, is readily achievable. In other words, you should do these guidelines if it's readily achievable. Readily achievable means it's convenient and will not have any significant cost. So it had no teeth. A complaint cannot be filed with an individual company. A complaint has to be filed with the FCC, and the FCC then contacts the company, as I understand it. Now, 508 has many of the same standards that were the guidelines for 255, except that now they're enforceable. Now they do affect. See, 508 is a market-driven approach to accessibility. Manufacturers don't have to follow 508, but if they don't, they won't be able to sell their products. So it's making it a market push. And this is what we think will have an effect with things like cell phones. And cell phones, again, it's a built-in sort of thing. It'd be very difficult, although they can make cell phones accessible to TTYs. It's the vision problem again, making that little tiny screen accessible. And they've got the hardware in there already. I mean, it can talk. It's got a little speaker and all. Software speech doesn't add much, but there's a lot of programming, and it depends on the first big orders that'll go out for, you know, cell phones in the government that'll have an impact. And I think you will. I'm as optimistic as I was in 89 about the GUI. Yeah, we'll have phones very shortly that are much more accessible.
Hmm. We must have, because it makes sense if given that the market is so depressed at the moment for cell phones.
Yeah.
Some enterprising person from some cell phone company is going to realize that if they are the first to produce an accessible cell phone, they scoop the pool.
Yeah, and that's very true. And I think one of the statements that I make that's not very popular with consumers is that one of the biggest problems that we have with 508 is the impatience of consumers. And I liked a statement made by a woman that I've worked with who was on our board, and she's severely hard of hearing, very nice person, though. And she says, when she gives, we've done presentations together, and she tells people, look, this isn't going to happen overnight. We're not necessarily doing this for ourselves. We're doing it for our kids. And I think it'll happen faster than that. But 508 is almost a revolution. And it is going to take time. And yeah, greedily and selfishly we say, we want it for me and I want it now. But in reality, 508 is going to take some time to train industry engineers and to gear up. And we're not going to have everything right at once. But just like, I don't know how many people remember the initial access to Windows 3.1. Never mind, Windows 3.1 wasn't so hot. The access to it was pretty squirrely. And it's 10 years later, it's much better. So let's look at cell phones 10 years from now.
That'd be a nice thought. Now, this is obviously going to, in all good market traditions, trickle down in terms of the products that consumers buy that the government also buys. But I wonder if you've got any views on the types of products that consumers buy that the government does not, and how we deal with that. For example, the problems with DVD players and videos and stereo systems that are becoming more menu-driven, washing machines, microwaves, all that stuff. I suppose the government buys some of those too, do they?
But yeah, but not as much. You have crime in Auckland?
Oh, absolutely. Well, it may well be a fire engine.
Well, that's true, except it's only one. It's a small fire. Anyway, the idea is, first of all, yes, the products that the government buys, we do not anticipate that industry will make two versions, a 508 compliant and a non-508 compliant. I mean, that would be foolish marketing.
Mm.
I think that once the product is changed, it'll become available to everybody. Now, I was in a situation at a conference in San Francisco where I had a chance to sit down and have lunch with a company that I really don't want to mention right now. Well, I will. Intuit. I'm a user of Quicken.
Right.
Quicken is not a 508 compliant product. We would like it to be for our personal use. The problem is, what leverage do we have to convince Quicken that it is a good idea? It is not part of their corporate thinking at this time, according to the people that I talked with. But they had come to the conference to kind of check out just what the current thinking and state of push for accessibility was. And I look at those products and I say, now, what leverage is there? Because the government doesn't buy Quicken, probably doesn't buy the, what is it called, the Home Legal, whatever, and doesn't buy TurboTax. But there are leverages. For example, if a assistive technology company goes to them and convinces them that with a little bit of work, they can increase a market share in terms of the consumers, because consumers that don't see are much more likely to use online banking, I think, than others. And so that's one push. There's another push, too, and that is, I've been able to do several presentations to bankers associations. And lots of times banks, as they move into online services, they'll do it in either of two ways. They'll use strictly a web-based, or they tie into the particular package that you're using, and download your statement right into, say, Quicken or Money or one of those. And they often actually supply these. The banks are much more interested in making their products accessible than some company like Intuit. And if the banks can be convinced to start putting pressure on more usable software for like these online services, that's where the pressure will come from.
Now, you raise for me a question which is quite fascinating, and maybe we'll only be able to deal with it briefly at this stage of the interview, but what actually constitutes accessibility? Because the ACB passed a resolution on Quicken at the convention in Kentucky in 2000, and not long after that, we actually had a person who did a, I think it was a six-part series for Main Menu on just how blind people can access Quicken. And so, you see, you get the situation where someone says that a product is inaccessible, and then you have someone coming out saying, well, I use it just fine every day.
This is one of my favorite topics when I give a presentation, because I've been asked to do sometimes sort of a keynote kickoff for a conference, and I raise the issue of accessibility, usability, and 508 compliance. And accessibility and usability are very hard to measure. Compliance is not hard to measure. And the only way that you can move towards accessibility is to have a set of programming standards or whatever you want, web design standards that stop thinking about accessibility and start thinking about following the standards. Because the minute somebody starts thinking about accessibility, somebody's going to come along and argue. This is accessible, this is not. But you don't have to argue. This program has keyboard functionality for all program functions. It either does or it doesn't. And you can't argue about it. You know what I mean? And that's the ultimate, is to have standards like that where somebody developing a program can follow the standards and say, okay, these are design standards, just like energy conservation or whatever. I don't have to worry about who's going to use it or why they're going to use it, but I do have to follow these standards. And you either have or you haven't. And that's the only way I think that you can assure reliable accessibility, because that also gives a mark for AT vendors to shoot for, because they know what the features are that the software people are required to put in.
So in fact, these standards, although not enforceable outside the government sector, could actually be quite useful, say when a blind person downloads a piece of shareware and there are some problems and the author's genuinely interested, but neither the author nor the blind person quite knows where to proceed from here. So maybe those standards could be sourced as some advice on how to fix the problems with the software.
Just like you would with web design.
Right.
You know, it's funny. People are very comfortable in knowing what to do about if they see a website that isn't right or something. They know that there are web design standards, and they can point them to WAI or they can point them to 508 and say, you need to follow these to learn how to do it. They don't know what to do about software. Software is the same thing. We have a website at the Access Board, which I will give you right now, and hopefully you'll repeat at the end, but it's www.access-board, not underscore, but -board.gov. And if you do a /508.htm, it'll drop you right into the page for the standards and for the technical assistance. And there's a whole section on software standards.
That's excellent. That's excellent. Well, at this point, we're just about at the end of our time, and it's gone fast, and people are arriving back, probably for some food, I hope.
Mm.
You never know, you know. But I hope you enjoy the remainder of your stay here, and that we'll keep in touch. It's been a fascinating couple of hours.
Well, actually, this has been fun, because I don't get a chance, generally, to just sort of reminisce about the old days.
That's great.
And so on. Everyone wants to know about 508. What do we have to do? And it was fun to talk about other things.
Good. I appreciate your time. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you.